The big four-engine airplane with the gleaming white star stood on the tarmac of a little airfield in Malta, ready to take Franklin Delano Roosevelt on a final mission. The new Douglas C-54 Skymaster had been specially fitted with all the latest conveniences, including an elevator that could lift the president and his wheelchair off the ground and deposit him in the belly of the plane. FDR voiced his displeasure to the Secret Service agents who wheeled him up to the tiny elevator cage. "I never authorized that," he muttered. "It's quite unnecessary." The embarrassed agents insisted that the device was required for security reasons. The alternative was a long ramp, a signal to enemy spies that the polio-stricken president of the United States was about to arrive or depart. Roosevelt, who disliked needless fuss and expense, was unconvinced. The departure schedule had been planned with choreographic precision. 30 military planes were lined up next to the small control tower, waiting for permission to take off. At 10-minute intervals, the lead plane moved to the head of the darkened runway, shades drawn, exterior lights extinguished. As each plane roared into the Mediterranean sky, the next plane moved into position behind. The night was filled with the roar of Skymaster and York transports warming their engines for takeoff and the high-pitched whine of fighter planes circling the airfield. Few people were aware of the existence of a presidential aircraft. Codenamed Project 51, its construction was such a closely guarded secret that those in the know referred to the plane as the Sacred Cow. Roosevelt had become the first U.S. president to travel by airplane 2 years earlier, in February 1943, when he took a Pan-American flying boat to Casablanca for a conference with Winston Churchill. But commercial air travel was obviously impractical for a wartime president, particularly one paralyzed from the waist down. The flying White House was ready for its inaugural trip. Roosevelt boarded the Sacred Cow at 11:15 on the evening of February 2, 1945. The plane was not scheduled to depart until 3:30 a.m., but his doctors had decided this was the best way for him to get a decent night's rest. He was rolled straight to his stateroom just aft of the wing. His black valet, Arthur Prettyman, helped him off with his clothes and made sure that he was lying comfortably on the plush three-seat couch emblazoned with the presidential seal. Other amenities included a swivel chair, a conference table, several closets, a private toilet, and a panoramic bulletproof window twice the width of regular portholes that was framed by blue curtains. A console next to the window provided communication with the cockpit and other parts of the plane. The interior wall opposite contained a set of maps on rollers that could be pulled down for in-flight briefings. A painting of a 19th-century clipper tossing in the waves filled the wall above the couch, evoking Roosevelt's love of the sea. The president was chronically tired. He had whiled away the 12-day crossing of the Atlantic on a U.S. Navy cruiser with endless rounds of gin rummy, deck games, and movies in the evening. He frequently slept 12 hours a night, but however much rest he got, it never seemed enough. Much of his remaining energy had been spent on his last election campaign, riding in open limousines and braving a torrential downpour in New York in a desperate attempt to show he was fit enough to serve a fourth term. The campaign appearances were designed to remind the voters of the FDR of popular imagination. Strong, indomitable, optimistic. But they concealed his rapidly deteriorating state of health. He had lost some 40 pounds over the last few months and looked like a skeleton. His blood pressure was out of control, sometimes as high as 260 over 150. The man he had chosen as Vice President, Harry S. Truman, was alarmed when they met for a symbolic photo-taking session at the White House. "I had no idea he was in such a feeble condition," Truman confided to an aide. "In pouring cream in his tea, he got more cream in the saucer than he did in the cup. There doesn't seem to be any mental lapse, but physically, he is going to pieces." Roosevelt's heart specialist, Howard Bruin, slipped into the cabin shortly before takeoff. The president was already snoozing. The young Navy lieutenant commander wanted to make sure his patient did not roll off the couch as the Sacred Cow accelerated down the runway. Knowing that Roosevelt would not have the strength to prevent himself from falling dead weight to the floor, Bruin turned the swivel chair so that its back was against the couch. He would sleep sitting down, alert to the noises behind him. Bruin was worried about FDR. When he first examined the president at Bethesda Naval Hospital in March 1944, he knew at once there was something terribly wrong and gave him no more than a year to live. His patient was having trouble breathing and was suffering from bronchitis. His heart was greatly enlarged, no longer able to pump blood efficiently. The cardiologist prescribed digitalis to control the heartbeat, an easily digestible diet, greatly increased rest, and a sharp cutback in the number of official visitors and duties. Roosevelt's chief physician, Vice Admiral Ross McIntyre, had resisted Bruin's recommendations because he did not want to disrupt the president's routine, but eventually agreed to a scaled-down version. On McIntyre's insistence, nobody outside a small circle of trusted White House doctors would know the facts about the boss's medical condition. Even Roosevelt was kept in the dark. Averse to unpleasant news, he displayed little interest in finding out the truth.